Calling all small firm architects, it's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast, it's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. James Caulfield, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you here, James. You and I have had some conversations before this podcast, and I'm looking forward to our conversations. Each time we speak, it sort of goes wherever it goes, and it's always an interesting conversation for me. And so we'll see where it goes. Let me introduce
you. It does ramble.
Let people know who you are. James Caulfield has been a professional photographer for more than 30 years. Creating compelling images of people, places, and things both here in the U.S. and abroad. His clients have included some of the largest brands in the world. In recent years, James has concentrated on food and beverage and architecture. His interest in architectural subjects grew out of his own efforts restoring a Frohman & Jebsen-designed bank in Chicago, a mid-century modern home in Glencoe by the noted architects Keck & Keck, and his repurposing of several industrial buildings in Chicago as studios in support of his advertising business. His passion for preservation led him to volunteer his services to the Frank Lloyd Wright Trust in Oak Park, Illinois, for whom he's documented the buildings on the Trust's annual internationally attended house walk, the Wright Plus. There, he met architectural writer Patrick F. Cannon in 2004, with whom he collaborated with on six books: Hometown Architect, Prairie Metropolis, Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple, Louis Sullivan, The Space Within, and his new book, At Home in Chicago, A Living History of Domestic Architecture, which is a study of the evolution of custom residential design in Chicago, showcasing James's photography of nearly 75 distinct residential designs, from log cabins to net energy projects. It's about 360 pages of photography. And so you should go check that out. And so I want to have you start at the beginning, James. I want to understand your origin story. When did you discover your passion for what you do, and what inspired you, or who inspired you, to become a photographer?
Is that relative to architecture or not?
Well, no, at the very beginning. Where did, because architecture came more recently, from what I understand. What inspired you in the beginning?
I think it got to a point where I had to decide what I would do to make a living. And I guess I entertained the idea that it might actually incorporate something creative. And I come from a background of music as well. And having picked up a camera as a teenager, as well as a number of my friends, and even learning how to work in a darkroom while still a teenager, I was being asked to take pictures of bands for promotional purposes. And I think that's where it started. And I was hooked, and I was fairly comfortable in those days shooting pictures of people as well.
Who actually gave you that first camera? Where did you get that camera? You said you picked up a camera when you were a teen. You know, where did that camera come from? Was it somebody in your family?
Yeah, it was a friend. There was a friend who had a basement where everyone assembled almost nightly for, you know, all the various things you could imagine, being that it was the 60s. Yeah. But, you know, there were always projects going on, design projects, some graphic design, some incorporating photography. I wanted to be involved, and it wasn't difficult to raise your hand and be recognized. And it led to, like I say, doing some work for bands, and that led to album covers.
What kind of music?
Well, it was a little bit of everything, primarily jazz. Mm-hmm. There was a time when I was asked to manage a jazz band, and ultimately did some photography for them, as well as booked them, and negotiated a record contract, and ended up doing that cover, as well as the cover of their next album, before I backed out because I got too busy with my advertising work at the studio. But we're talking way back. This is early 70s.
Yes. When for you, during that time, when you picked up the camera and you started shooting because it was something interesting and creative, to starting to manage those bands and recognize that photography was a part of that with album covers, when did it become, did you become aware that this could be a profession for you, that it was more than just this cool thing that I was doing to be part of the group, to realizing that there was something that I could do for my career?
I had absolutely no sense that I couldn't do it as a career or for a living. I was doing a number of things all at the same time because I had, you know, being a kid, I had endless energy. And photography was just one of my part-time jobs. I was also going to school. I was tending bar in those days. I was also managing a consulting firm where I was the only consultant, and my primary client was the First National Bank of Chicago, and I was specializing in database design back when IT was called data processing.
So a computer guy too. Very.
I was a computer guy in those days. Yeah, math major in school, and then a computer guy, and ended up writing a systems development methodology to enable analysts to design better systems and programmers to write better programs. And then ultimately took on the responsibility of myself of designing the data because no one else had thought of it, I guess. And then I developed a set of rules or a methodology for how to do that. And the reasons behind it, Mark, was to make programs run faster.
Yeah.
Because programming systems in those days were running incredible amounts of information for many, many clients, but they were on very early computers that the batch work essentially would take all night, and they couldn't open the bank in the morning because it wasn't done and the reports weren't printed and they weren't on the desks, and there were no, you know, terminals on people's desks to enable them to get or access information. So those reports were quite important. And like I say, I came up with a technique for designing data that dovetailed into their plans at the time and ended up saving them. It was successful. Let me just put that out there, and it saved them a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they enjoyed having me around, and they were paying me in terms of the 70s, I was making an incredible amount of money per hour, and I could name my hours. So I couldn't say no. And, yeah. And I did it for about almost 10 years. And
so did you did both? You did that work and photography at the same time?
Yes, sir. And like I say, I was in school.
Yeah.
I was pursuing a degree at the time, and I was tending bar, and I was managing the jazz band. And
so at that time, thinking back at that time where you're doing all those different things, did you have sort of a plan? Like, this is what I think my life would look like in the future? Or were you just sort of rolling with it and see where it went?
Well, I'm your average stream of consciousness, seat of the pants, day by day kind of guy. I generally haven't done much in the way of planning.
So move towards the things that work and abandon the things that don't and see where it takes you.
If it hurts too bad, then stop doing that.
So you eventually became a very well documented fashion photographer. So how did you get from data analysis to fashion photography?
Well, there were coincident events, and they were part of that quest I mentioned to you earlier about trying to incorporate something creative into what I would do.
Yeah.
And musical promotional photography and album covers was one avenue that was available to me, but I realized at the time that fashion photography was another. It seemed like you had unlimited control over what you were doing, even more so than I had experienced photographing bands. And so I kind of went in that direction and tested together a portfolio. I had resources, I'll put it to you that way, because of that consulting firm.
Right.
But it enabled me to have a studio and buy equipment and, like I say, test together a portfolio and find an agent. And all of that paid off like with immediacy I couldn't have imagined. I think as soon as the agent took the book to the first client, I was working. Could have been same day, but it was probably the next day.
Yeah. So you created a portfolio, put it out there with an agent who had some connections and got work. When did the realization that photography was going to be the path, and where did you sort of stop with the computers and the data work to sort of pursue the photography full time?
Well, that's interesting. I'm going to say 1984, that's my recollection. I was booked, I think it was Northbrook Court Shopping Center, whatever agency was handling that account back in the day, and Marshall Fields, both through my agent, decided to allow me to take photographs of my own design while I was in first, it was a recreational trip as that started out, and I was gonna go to Cairo for a week, and then I was gonna go to Paris for a week following, just to relax and then come back. And my agent got wind of it, and he started selling the concept to people of, why don't you give him some clothes, and while he's there, he'll shoot them, and he'll come back with some pictures, It worked. All of a sudden, I was carrying clothes and taking my studio manager along with me and photographing while I was there.
A free ride to Cairo.
And, just being gone for those 2 weeks and returning to Chicago, I just thought, I can't, for the life of me, imagine going back to the office anymore and doing what I had been doing, suited up and sitting at a desk.
Yeah.
Dealing with people who were primarily 20 years older than I was.
The creative side won.
But it was all serendipity.
Yeah.
It wasn't planned. It just got to the point where I said, okay, that's it.
It sounds like and through conversations with you that it sounds like the control that you had as a photographer was appealing, that there was less control on the computer side with your destiny, like where you were headed, than on the photography side. You can sort of set your own rules, do your own thing, be more creative the way you want it to be as a photographer. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, control, I think, is attractive to humans, or even the, the impression, or, you know, I don't think we really have it. And I think the times that it even rears its ugly head are fleeting in life. But in terms of creative control as a fashion photographer in the early 80s, there were so many clients to work for, and there were so few photographers doing what I was doing, that I was immediately amongst just a handful of guys who were elite. And when they hired me, my recollection of this anyway, was that they loved the idea of me shooting these pictures for them, based, I would assume, on what they had seen that I had done.
Yeah.
And that's what gave me the energy to move into that space and do that for them. It was a service, but it felt good, because I felt like those people really appreciated me and really wanted whatever it is I came up with. And, you know, there was always exceptions to that, but, and sometimes there was a lot of pressure applied along with that sentiment. I mean, some art directors, I remember one doing an advertising job in New York, where he just kept saying to me over and over again, "This has to be the best thing you've ever done." And after a while, I just and walk out, but you know, I did the best I could, but that didn't make it a fun experience.
Yeah.
I'd much rather people just say, "Hey, you know, do what you do, and I'm sure it'll be fine." But those days are gone. They really are, I think, unless you are actually amongst the elite, but no longer.
How did you connect with your agent? Where, because that seems to be the thing that sort of, you know, was the catalyst to turn the photography into a career. Where did that connection come
from? To a great degree. I think you're right, Mark. It was a mutual friend who was a makeup artist that I was working with at the time, who would come over and do test shoots with me to create samples to go into both of our portfolios, as well as the models. And she liked what I was doing enough to say, "Look, I've got this guy who you got to meet, because I think you guys could really do something together." And he was working in an ad agency, but wanted to leave and become an agent. And I think he was probably open to finding a talent that he could work with. And it was timing.
Yes.
One of those things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So you've worked with dozens.
And he was incredible, by the way. He was an incredible agent, and just one of those people, unlike me, he could just walk into a room and people would love him. Love him. Yeah, and they couldn't spend enough time with him, and they couldn't throw enough work his way. And once again, that was just serendipity, because I had never met him before.
Yeah. That's a very important piece of the puzzle, though, right? Because we're talking to architects, right? We're talking to small firm architects, a lot of them very creative people, many of them not so interested in the business side, right? That it's not their strength. It's not the thing that they love most. And so the fact that you found a person who you could essentially partner with to do the things that you didn't either like to do or you weren't good at, somebody that sort of can walk into a room and resonate with anybody that they connect with, that's a powerful piece to the puzzle, right? That you're a very talented creative, but all by yourself, you probably would have never gotten to the level that you attained without that partnership with somebody who can introduce you to the people that needed to be introduced to.
True that.
Yeah. And architects, you know, should find that too, right? That if you are struggling as an architect, it's likely because there are pieces of the business puzzle that are missing, right? And so if you find somebody who can thrive, not only will that's willing to do it, but loves to do it, right? That your agent probably loved to make those connections, to have those conversations and make those deals. It's probably something that they were passionate about. And so architects can do that too, where they find that person who can be passionate about the things that you're not so much passionate about.
Yeah.
So you've worked with some of the most well-known brands in the world, working in photography and food and beverage. How did you get into the food and beverage thing? Was that just basically an evolution of the process of being a photographer and those connections you were being making?
Yeah, I was learning how to age gracefully and stay in the business to one, you know, to that's one point I think I should make. Fashion photography is for youngsters, and I'll leave it at that. But I was trying to find something that would enable me, because at the time I found myself married and with children, and it was trying to find a way to stay in town, number one, and get home for dinner.
Yeah.
Maybe be home on weekends, and becoming a studio photographer and staying away from fashion and models and locations was a major desire of mine at that point. And product photography, still life photography, and the technical challenges of it were interesting to me. They were even provocative, and that dovetailed nicely into the whole transition of the business from film to digital and to computers that I thought I left forever when I became a photographer. So, you know, things do in an odd sort of way come full circle.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode is brought to you by BQE, the makers of BQE Core, Systems and Standard Operating Procedures. You already know that that's how to build a profitable business and find the freedom you want. You need systems and procedures. But you struggle with choosing which systems you need most and how to implement those systems quickly so you can get back to doing what you love most. The Designing Your Business Masterclass series was created by acclaimed architect and business consultant Douglas Teeger to help fellow architects and engineers run their firms more profitably while maintaining a healthy work-life balance. Douglas grew from a solo practitioner to become managing partner of his 30-plus person firm, and then later sold his firm so he can do what he does today, helping architects be more successful at Teeger Consulting. On the third Wednesday of every month, Douglas dives deep into an essential topic that will strengthen the profitability of your firm and make it sustainable for growth in the years to come. Register now for the next Designing Your Business Masterclass with Douglas Teeger at bqe.com/masterclass and start implementing powerful systems for the profitability you need and the freedom you want. Every live masterclass session includes AIA continuing education credit, and when you visit bqe.com/masterclass, you'll have access to the full library of past sessions on demand. The Designing Your Business Masterclass is free, and it's brought to you by our friends at BQE, the makers of BQE Core, the software that makes it easy to manage your projects and people for maximum productivity and ultimate profitability. Register now for the Designing Your Business Masterclass at bqe.com/masterclass. That's bqe.com/masterclass. This episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. There's a lot to love about being an entrepreneur architect, right? But trying to figure out your financials on your own is not one of those things. Luckily, there's FreshBooks, the all-in-one accounting solution that's built for business owners like us. FreshBooks takes all the not-so-fun parts of running a business, from building and tracking invoices to managing online payments to organizing expenses, and automates them with features like the new digital bills and receipt scanner, saving you up to 11 hours per week in the process. 11 hours. FreshBooks has your back at tax time, too. It's almost tax time. With a ton of reports to choose from, you'll know exactly where your business stands, and you can easily hand the keys over to your accountant so they can take over when it's time to reconcile everything for the year. try FreshBooks. Try FreshBooks for free for 30 days. No credit card required. It's free. Go to FreshBooks.com/architect. FreshBooks.com/architect to get started today. That's FreshBooks.com/architect. So what will you do with your 11 more hours each week? This episode is brought to you by Arcat.com. We all have that one story, that one project that had such a unique situation that it required a solution that you had rarely considered before. We share these stories in private professional circles with our friends and our colleagues, but there has never been a collection of these stories of conflict and triumph all in one place until now. Detailed is a podcast series that features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who share their insights and expertise as they highlight some of the most complex, interesting, and oddball building conditions that they have ever encountered, and the ingenuity it took to solve them. Join host Charisse Lakeside, aka CSI Kraken, a senior specifications writer at RDH Building Science, as she uncovers lessons learned to help you navigate similar challenges that may arise in your next project. Detailed, an original podcast by Arcat. Listen and subscribe right now at arcat.com/podcast. That's arcat.com/podcast. arcat.com/podcast. Detailed. Every building has a story. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. I love that completion of the cycle that you started in computers and tech and loved that and thrived in it. And the creative side just took over, and there was a season that you were all in creative. And then because of the evolution of our society and technology, it all came right back around. And so then you can leverage your knowledge and your passion for the technology to even improve the creativity that you were experiencing.
And the control that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
It felt like there was so much more control over the whole process. You knew if it was in focus, for one. You knew if it was exposed properly. And if I was shooting people, and I still was when digital happened, you knew if you had the expression and you knew if the clothes looked the way they needed to look. It wasn't like you would just shoot a lot of film until the art director asks you if you have it. And then you kind of go, well, yeah, I think so. And then you have to wait till the next day to see the film when it gets back from the lab to find out that, no, you really didn't have it. Or,
yeah,
luckily there it is.
Yeah. And digital is very different, right? Digital, you're actually looking at a large monitor where you can check the exposure, check the focus. See the expressions.
Yeah. So, the control factor was definitely there. And that was part of the provocative aspect to it. Plus, it enabled me to get more technically involved in the process rather than just this creative shoot from the hip guy with a camera who would toss the film to his assistant and it would end up in a lab and come back and there it is. I would have literally no more to do with it except a selection edit and send those to the client. But in digital, there's infinite numbers of ways to get involved in the process. And the process keeps growing for me.
Yeah. So tell me, so you did fashion to food and beverage, and now you're doing a little, more recently, some architecture. You've written 6 books with Patrick Cannon about architecture, specifically Frank Lloyd Wright and the work that he's done in Chicago. Tell me the story of meeting Patrick.
Yeah, and let me for sure tell you that Patrick is writing these books.
Yeah. Patrick's writing and your photography.
Yeah, it's a concept that he comes up with. We discuss. I may have something to say about altering a little bit, but I generally try not to step on his desires when it comes to these things. And find other ways later on to inhabit it. I've been somewhat successful at that, though I think that now on this latest book, I'll just add this here and now, I'm designing it as well as having photographed it, because I think that it's a real integral part of the process.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with any visual art, selecting the images and then deciding where they will go and what other images they will live with on the page and how they will be cropped. It's all very intimate stuff that I've always handed over to somebody else and been unhappy with the outcome of. So this one I'm designing myself. But back to your question with Pat, it was me volunteering for the Frank Lloyd Wright Trust. And because I found that I wanted to do something other than advertising. And I did have an interest in architecture and Frank Lloyd Wright. Exactly where that comes from, I don't know. I could invoke my father, I suppose. But one day, after having been ignored for, I think, 2 years by the trust, one day I got a call asking me to come to a meeting to discuss a book they wanted to do and to meet the author, and walked into a conference room and there was Pat, and really the rest is history. And it was a very successful book that's still in print and still makes the trust a lot of money. Yeah. And I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, had never photographed architecture before, but I don't know, Mark, it just kind of worked out somehow.
Yeah.
Well, I look at the book and I could certainly improve it, and I've offered. And in fact, I've even made real steps towards doing that by re-photographing things that I thought just needed to be re-represented in the next revision of the book. But the trust is going with it because it works for them.
Yeah.
Their attitude is it's not broke, so why fix it?
Right.
So it stays in its current state.
So your interest in architecture comes from some of the work that you've done in terms of renovations for your own buildings and your own businesses. That led you to start shooting pro bono work for the trust, or volunteering for the trust to shoot some of their work through an interest of that type of photography.
That's a difficult question to answer. I think that, yes, I had an interest in architecture, but I think it, once again, we get back to control, but I liked very much to be able to control the space that I inhabited, whether it was my home or my studio. And for me, one of the beautiful things about being a photographer is I could justify having a studio. So
yeah.
I could have two spaces to control, not just one. It wasn't just my house. Yeah. I could build a studio and furnish that and fill it with equipment and decide how the workflow would happen there. It was another provocative thing.
Yeah.
And I had already been through that process a number of times by the time I heard from the trust.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I was dialed in, I suppose, all my sensors were working as far as space and style and design. But when I contacted them, I had no idea what I'd be doing for them.
Yeah.
And so, I didn't know if it would be something I would like doing, and I didn't know if it would have any legs. But gosh, I think it's 14 or 15 years later, and I'm still shooting the Wright Plus Tour promotional photography and anything else that comes up in between.
Yeah. And now six books into working with Patrick. So what is it about books that you enjoy? Because I could see doing one book because the trust asked you to. What made you do the second book and then the next and then the next and the next? What is it about the publishing of a book that appeals to you?
Once again, nobody looking over my shoulder and telling me what to do is a huge factor in it, or how to do it. And Pat and I would generally come up with a list of buildings that would be in any given book. And then I'm essentially cut loose to do whatever I need to do or want to do for sometimes a period up to 4 years. I'll work on a book. So there's no fire under me. There's nobody breathing down my neck. And Pat generally likes to pull the plug after about 2.5, 3 years, I'd say. He pretty much feels like, all right, this thing has got to get done. And he'll impose an artificial deadline that I'll respect. But I mean, honestly, I could still be working on the space within. And I'm not kidding you. I would be happy to be traveling around photographing great buildings in Chicago still. And maybe volume 2 or 3 would have happened by now. I don't know. But it's hard for me to stop once I get going. I'm a collector by nature.
Yeah. So now you have the new book at home in Chicago. You're designing. Did you design that book too?
No, I didn't.
And so you're designing the new book?
Yes, sir. Yes,
what's the new book about?
It's a revision of what I believe was the second book.
The Prairie Metropolis?
No, it must have been the third then, Mark. And it was
Unity
about,
Temple.
Yeah, it was showcasing one building.
Yep.
And to me, that was kind of attractive. I had never tried to do that before. And I thought my in and out on this whole project could be, you know, relatively short term. So I agreed to that one pretty darn quick.
Yeah.
I think when I shot that book, I maybe did it with 3 visits to the temple, 4 at the most, counting the exterior. And I just had a different perception then than I do now of what the process of making a book is about, or what documenting a building can be about. And at the time I was like, okay, here you go. And once again, it went off. I had nothing to say about what photographs they used or how they were laid out on the page. And the design of it was very poor. And I think even the, I could say the printing, was not lovely. So to have an opportunity to get our hands on that book, I think the publisher elected not to revise the book or go into another printing. And the requisite amount of time has passed and they just said, okay, you guys can have it now if you want it. And Pat, you know, took it and then approached me and asked me if I wanted to re-photograph it again now that it's been restored. And yeah, I bet. And I've probably been there 40 times easy photographing the building this time around, and feel pretty good about what I have, much better than what I had the first time around, but really didn't want to give it to anybody. I was feeling protective of it to such a degree that I told Pat, I'm not going to give up the photography if you give this to someone else to
design. An ultimatum.
Yeah, first time I had done that.
Yeah.
So he agreed. God so bless him. He just said, yeah, we'll let you do this one. And we had money lovingly donated by the Driehaus Foundation to do this book basically in its entirety without us having to go into pocket. And that was a lovely experience. And I'm getting a pretty good amount of money to do this as well, you know, going rate. And since I have never designed a book before, and I'm the first one to admit it, I told Pat, well, I'll take the money, but I'm going to split it with another designer or two who we can co-design this book with, and they'll essentially be there to help solve technical problems as they come up
and fill the gaps,
dot my I's and cross my T's. So I've been working with a good friend, Bill Sozin, who's a wonderful designer and a photographer in his own right. And it's been a wonderful experience. And I think it's looking real good. I'm a little excited about this.
When is it scheduled to be finished and published?
Well, I think Pat's arbitrary deadline this time was May 1st. So I'll have something designed that he's in agreement with by then. And then we'll send it off to the land of printing presses, China.
So this summer sometime it'll come out.
Yeah, I think he wants it in the stores by fall. Since this one I'm designing, no publisher would touch it. They want control.
Sure.
And so we're essentially self-publishing, and Pat is in the process now of finding a distributor.
Yeah.
So that's the last piece. And if we can find a decent distributor, I think this book's going to do pretty well.
Well, that's very exciting. It's exciting that you sort of have taken on all these different responsibilities of that book, sort of learning through six books, and then taking one and reworking it, and not only designing it, but publishing it and distributing it and sort of going through the whole process of publishing. What's your future look like? What's the next few years of James Caulfield look like?
To think about that.
Yeah, it sounds like your whole career has been an evolution. That sort of you just take the next thing that comes along and do it well. It's all creative based. But
it's nice to be open on one hand. It's also nice to respond honestly and determine for myself if something feels good or not.
Yeah. Do more books, you think?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm just an old school guy, and as that goes. And I really like books. I've always liked books. I've always been an avid reader, at least when I was younger and had the time. I used to read quite a bit, to the exclusion of most everything else. And the addition of pictures into a book, you know, you got me. I give up. I hope to do more. Yeah. And I hope to have time to do it properly and, you know, be given the opportunity.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's who knows, you get hit by the proverbial bus tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it's all over. But for now, yeah, I would welcome it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll be with Pat. I'm getting the feeling that Pat is questioning whether he would do another book or not, but we'll see.
Well, keep us posted. I'm interested. You have a fascinating story. It's I'd love to hear how it started and where you are today, and the book that's coming out. At Home in Chicago is your most recent book. Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple, coming this summer or fall. When that does publish, let us know, and we'll push it out to our community as well. James, what is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Yeah, I said it already. Just be true to yourself. Be honest.
Yeah.
And be sensitive enough to know what feels right.
Good answer.
You know, be a good person. Don't hurt people. Be nice to people.
That's my answer.
I could give that, you know, advice to anybody. And I think it's all good advice. And I think it's true. I'm not just blowing smoke.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree. I end every episode of this podcast, this is episode 453, with the words love, learn, share. Wow. Those are the three things that I want to leave my kids, that if they ask me, what do I need to know? That's what you need to know. Love, learn, and share. His name is James Caulfield. You can, the book is named At Home in Chicago, A Living History of Domestic Architecture. That's the current book that's out now. You can learn all about James and his photography and the books all at caulfieldphoto.com. We'll have a link to that on the show notes. You could just go there and click the link, and that'll take you right there. James, thank you for coming by and sharing your story with our community here at Entree Architect Podcast.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Mark.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review. Go write a review. I would love to know what you think of this podcast, and it helps other architects find us. So go do 5-star rating if you like it, share it, write a review, I'd love it, and share a link to this episode with a friend, because that's how we've grown. That's how Entre Architect has grown to serve thousands of architects throughout the world just like you. Thank you to our sponsors, RCAT, FreshBooks, and BQE for their support of this episode. I ask you to support them because they support us. And if they're supporting us, they're supporting you. So go support them. Got it? Go support our sponsors. Links to our sponsors. So you can click on those links and go right to them. Links to our sponsors and all the resources we shared today are available at the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. All the shows are there. entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entre Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows. I think there are 11 of them there now. Go there, gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And I hope you're going to join us in Austin November 1st through November 3rd, 2022. Those are the dates for the Entre Architect Community Annual Meeting, our first ever live and in-person conference for you, the small firm architect community. Visit entrearchitect.com/annual meeting right now to learn more. That's entrearchitect.com/annual meeting, and I will see you in Austin in November. Don't miss this. This is going to be great. entrearchitect.com/annual meeting. It's a conference for you, small firm architects. Thank you for listening today to this episode of Entre Architect Podcast. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick. So when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entre Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges. just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.